The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
Okay, there were a couple of things. One that I don't think we completed very well. Question six, I asked, what are the conditions that make it likely in a species that mate choice will be exercised by the males? If you're just looking at a number of species, what do you think you would see if you could see both the male and the female? What would you see in species where there was mate choice by the males? It doesn't mean that the female doesn't also exert choice of a mate, but I just want to know what you first would look for. Yeah. If there are many more females, if you could see the whole population, yes, that would certainly be one thing. But if you could only see the pair, to make a choice, they have to have some basis for making the choice, right? And often it's their ornamentation, their coloration, plays a role. See? So you look for particularly bright colors. They may appear only, though, at mating time. That's true for the fish that's described in the last chapter of the Scott book, fish that develops a bright orange belly right at the time when she's got a lot of eggs. And the males tend to choose the ones that are brighter. Scott also points out that even though it might seem that males will have a simpler problem, they're going to indiscriminately mate with as many females as possible, what would tend to inhibit that besides what we talked about in the Siberian hamster? You just deal with fish, for example. The text points out that there's a limit, if he's defending the nest, there's a limit to how many eggs he'll be able to defend. You know, so he might be able to have eggs from more than one female, maybe two or three, but there's a limit to how many he can deal with. So he can't be just totally indiscriminate and promiscuous. He's got to limit the number of mates, so that will tend to make him be a little bit choosy. And this is based on observations of, you know, mating in many different animals, many different species. Now, about the mating systems, I want you to go back and look at that figure on the dunnets. Okay? And we may bring it up again, so I'll get it into my computer so you can see it. But it's right there in the book. It's in that last chapter. Because that's such an important study in dealing with mating systems. His analysis can all be explained in evolutionary, in ultimate terms, evolutionary benefit. Okay, when we ended the class, we were talking about sperm competition. And I said, describe at least one means by which sperm competition could occur after mating. And the only factor we mentioned was just the quantity of semen, quantity of the ejaculate would make a difference. Well, what other things could produce competition? We're not talking about here necessarily males competing with other males or females competing with females. We're talking about sperm competition. Sounds a little strange. And there's a lot of speculation still in the area about humans. But remember how I talked about how a female insect could be inseminated by one male? and another male comes along, what chance does he have? Well, he's got a good chance if he's got an organ where he can remove the previous semen, right? Well, what about the sperm themselves? Maybe the second one could... Now, let's just speculate. How could he do it? Maybe he could inject a toxin first. Kill off the other. Practice a little birth control before he goes in. Also, some sperm are more energetic than others. Okay. What factors make the semen more energetic? Well, we don't know everything, but it seems to me it's possible that you could get that kind of competition. Although we think just numbers to give it a statistical more. But what things could the female do? Say she copulates with several males. Does that mean she has no control over which male is going to inseminate her eggs? Or what egg, if that's the case? Have any of you read about this at all? It wasn't a term even used much in behavioral studies until just a few years ago, this idea of sperm competition. But because it's gotten into the literature, it probably tends to be censored in a lot of places. It's a very real phenomenon. It's been studied now very well in a number of different species. The female might have a means of storing semen. Let's say she mates with a very vigorous male and accepts then later matings. She could hold the sperm of the first male in some kind of storage. Okay? And then later, if she finds a better male, she won't release that first sperm. That's another kind of sperm competition where the female's controlling it, at least potentially. And there is evidence that this can occur. I've forgotten which species it belongs, but just the idea I want to get across. And the speculations I've seen have suggested that this kind of thing even happens in humans, although there's argument about that. That they claim that there were things about female anatomy that were missed in the earlier studies. And in fact, there's a possibility of this kind of competition, even in humans. Although the other things we were talking about also have been seen in humans. Like the bird that when he sees his mate near another male, he comes back, and what does he do? He doesn't cast her out, he mates with her again because there's a recency effect, the most recent sperm, especially if she's storing some. Often the most recent that gets in will be the first to get out and mate and fertilize the eggs. Okay, now there were a couple other topics, a couple other questions. Question 12 and 13. 12 was, what has DNA analysis revealed about female sandpipers who desert a first clutch of eggs? They lay four eggs, and they often will lay the four eggs with one male, and they'll be staying there, and then another male will come around, she'll leave the nest, just desert the first male, and he will stay there and take care of those eggs because that's his best chance of reproducing. She finds another mate and lays four more eggs. What has DNA analysis revealed about that? Yeah.
It shows that even though the second bird might have mated with her, those eggs aren't totally eggs.
The eggs may have been fertilized by the first male.
Yeah.
Because she has that ability to store sperm. You know, if she decides that he was the better one, you know, But remember, how is she benefiting and how are the males benefiting? The second male is the one that might lose out here. The female benefits a lot because now she's had 8 eggs, all fertilized, all capable of growing up, because the first male is taking care of that first clutch of eggs. And the second male might take care of the second clutch of eggs without realizing they're not his. And that we didn't know about that until DNA analysis was used. Then we realized that it has to be some storage. In mammals, I can't think of anything very similar. I know that in kangaroos, when the kangaroo mates, she will generally have one joey, but she will keep a fertilized embryo inside her, and it won't start developing unless something happens to the first joey, her offspring. And if something happens, then that other embryo will grow up inside her, but fertilized by the same male, you see. She literally can store the embryo and keep it from developing. So that's related to the same idea. But in this case, it's not an unfortunate male that's taking care of somebody else's offspring. So the last question was about the lek. Do you know, can somebody define a lek?
The book defined as a singles bar.
Yeah, the singles bar. The male's on display. It's quite a phenomenon. It happens, it's not real common, but it happens not just in insects, but also in birds and some mammals, where not just a few males, but quite a few males will be all in a very small area, maybe in tiny little territories, okay, literally on display, and the females all show up there. And the females make their choice of the males. And often the lek forms around one particularly healthy male, particularly large, particularly colorful, or whatever. And so in many cases, doesn't always happen. Sometimes a number of males will be mating. But there are cases, there are leks where the females will all mate with one male. So the question was, how can a male in a lek who never succeeds in mating with a female nevertheless benefit in evolutionary terms by his participation in the lek? And the answer is similar to one we've given before in class about related situations. Can somebody remember? Yeah.
He's related to that, he's increasing his chance of similar genes.
Yes, and the more closely he's related, the better, right? If it's his brother, that's particularly good. And that's called the kin selection model of lek formation. And there are other models. You should check that. There's several other things that people have thought of trying to explain why leks occur. But sociobiologists, in this case, Alcock, who's not just a sociobiologist, he's an animal behaviorist who has studied proximate mechanisms as well. He seems to favor the kin selection model also. It doesn't mean that only one model is true, of course, but that's one that at the moment is easiest to understand. Okay, class 21. Where we're starting to go through this book. It's pretty easy reading. We will go through fairly rapidly. It's the only other complete book we'll be going through. title for the first question called Burn This Book. I didn't get these posted until about 8:45 this morning because I fell asleep last night. This move has been a little hard. I fell asleep and didn't get it posted. I guess when I woke up, I didn't have it in me to do anything but go to bed. Okay, so my first question is, why did a group of scientists that included prominent professors from MIT and Harvard write what could be called a manifesto published in the New York Review of Books in 1975, shortly after the publication of this big new book by Edward O. Wilson called Sociobiology, The New Synthesis? Anybody else? You've asked a lot, answered a lot. Now let's see somebody else.
I was going to ask you if you were here around that time.
I was here. I sure was. I remember it well. And I can tell you who some of the professors were doing it. I was not one of them. I would not join that group. I don't like suppression of any kind of science. And I looked at his book, and I could see a lot of what they were claiming is just not true. And I also talked to Edward O. Wilson, but that was I talked to him shortly after that. And I also got him invited. He's given talks here at MIT. And when he first came, they literally had to have a lot of police around, you know, because they were worried about the activists. But anyway, a little more about that. Anybody? Why was this so controversial? What were these people so upset about? Yeah.
One of the reasons.
Yeah, go ahead.
One of the reasons is that it wasn't founded on real science.
That's what they claim. Pseudoscience. This is just like the eugenics things, you know, that the Nazis believed in. I mean, they were extreme, some of their arguments. You have another one? Yeah. Let's just expand on this a little more. Alcock I like. The reason I picked this book is because he goes through all their objections, summarizes it very nicely, and then deals with it one by one. You know, particularly rants against Stephen Jay Gould, who I sort of like. His articles are nice, but I sure didn't agree with him on this point. Yeah?
They saw his theory as a kind of justification of human behaviors that are undesirable, like oppression of the poor by the rich and rape and
That's
social
right.
inequalities of other kinds.
Justifying status quo situations, the sort you're mentioning, they said it was politically bad. I even met people who said, well, even if he's right about a lot of it, it's still bad. Can't allow that. So do you think science shouldn't be done if it is difficult to deal with like that? Might give fodder for the people that have Nazi-like ideas. Look, people like that, like the Nazis, they'll do it anyway without science. Better that scientists produce some things that are true. You know what to believe. You know how to deal with it. They claimed a lot, though, besides that. In his list there, just mention a few, if I can find it. It was in his introduction. They said this was something idiosyncratic, just something E.L. Wilson produced. Well, if you look carefully at the book, you can see that it's not that at all. You know, he's reviewing large numbers of scientific studies. How many of you have seen the book, Sociobiology? Have seen it? Okay, I will bring my. I have a copy of my show. His earlier books were like the Insect Societies. In fact, the latest version of that came out after Sociobiology. But he had done a lot of work on insects. And he summarized that in big books also with a student of his. He's an expert in insect societies, Bill Wilson. They claim they acted like He was mainly concerned with humans. About 5% of the book is concerned with humans. And he states very clearly that this is more speculative and so forth, but there were data he could cite even there. Most of it's about animals, animal societies. A lot of insects. When they talk about traits that were dealt with by sociobiologists, they implied that sociobiologists believed in some kind of rigid genetic determinism. You know, that if something has been inherited, then it's been determined that if you have a certain gene, you're going to behave in a certain way. But that's not what sociobiologists claim at all. It's a it's an over reductionistic view of what they do. Some of them had a view of human instincts, and this isn't just some of the scientists, the biologists that were opposed to Wilson. You know, sociologists didn't like it, feminists didn't like it. Not all, there were some feminists that were better scientists than that, but it was opposed by many of them. But they had a view of instincts. They believed they were something very rigid, not capable of any plasticity, not capable of change. Well, we know, we've spent here half the term talking about this, and we know that maybe some of them are pretty rigid, but many of them are not. That's why they've been difficult to study in humans, because there's so much plasticity, so much integration and development. But I think the biggest things were this, the things we mentioned here at the beginning, and it's I list pages for you. It's in his page 20, which is right at the end of that chapter. He goes back to that and brings up something that I had not paid attention to. I only paid attention to it as science and politics, but he points out here that about the mid-70s when this was done, it was a period of intense political activity. The Vietnam War was going on. There was a lot of opposition to the war. And some of the scholars that got most involved in raising ideological objections to things were Marxists, including Lewontin and Gould. And so, and he quotes, and this surprised me. One of the quotes from them, they wrote, "As working scientists in the field of evolutionary genetics and ecology, we have been attempting with some success to guide our own research by a conscious application of Marxist philosophy. There's nothing in Marx, Lenin, or Mao that is or that can be in contradiction with the particular physical facts and processes of a particular set of phenomena in the objective world." That shocked me a little bit. It reminds me a lot, when I first visited the Soviet Union, went to Moscow in the late 60s to a scientific meeting, and every Russian that gave a talk had to cite Pavlov, and he had to praise Pavlov in some way, and he had to make sure that he wasn't stating something that was opposed to Pavlov, because Pavlov had become the official state doctrine about the explanation of behavior. And by the way, they rejected all of instinct. Everything was a conditioned reflex, all learned, you see. But it was amazing how it had become, how politicized it was. And yet, they had this International Congress of Psychology, and we certainly didn't get up and talk about Pavlov the way they did. But that was the first time I ran into this kind of problem. The second time was this. Probably a few others that I'm forgetting about. Okay, what is the primary analytical tool of the sociobiologist besides his computer? According to Alcock. What is he doing? That's the main thing he's using to think about social behavior in animals. What?
He says it's evolutionary theory.
Evolutionary theory. And then he points out at some length that this is... We're not dealing with a hypothesis. We're dealing with an accepted theory with enormous amounts of supportive evidence. It's nothing we're just speculating about. It's accepted by almost all biologists and people doing areas related to biology. Basically Darwinian evolution. And so then I asked a question about this very simple experiment illustrating a sociobiology experiment that he illustrates in this picture, the whirligig beetles, asking the simple question about why they aggregate. Why do they form these large groups of beetles on the surface of the water? Some of you have seen them, you know, and these little bugs that gather in these large groups. Why do they do that? Well, there's different ways to ask a why question, different kinds of why, different answers rather to a why question. And we met that and we talked about Tinbergen. And remember, one of Tinbergen's questions was about evolution. And if you're a sociobiologist, then you're concerned with social behavior of animals and you're concerned with adaptive evolution. So you're asking, why did this evolve? What function does it serve? How is it helping these beetles to pass on their genes? In other words, to survive better so they can reproduce. Okay, now according to that group that opposed sociobiology, they said it's purely speculative, there's no science involved. Which of course is not true. In this example, the people that were studying whirligig beetles immediately designed an experiment and tested their theory. They said it must help them survive predators better. So let's test it. So they set up large fish tanks, put the beetles in there, and they put a trout in there that feeds on these beetles. Okay? And let's compare then different sizes of the group of the aggregates of beetles. Single beetles, small groups of beetles, large aggregates, the way they do in nature. And we'll see what happens to these different groups when we put the trout in. And, of course, they found that the large, just according to those things we were talking about before, the previous class about anti-predator behavior, when they're in large groups, the chances that any one of them would be eaten were reduced if they were in the aggregate because of the dilution effect. So it was good for survival that they aggregate. At least statistically. So that was the test. Now there's other ways to test the same idea, but this was their experimental test. You have to make a few assumptions about your situation being comparable enough to the wild situation and so forth. But and there are field methods of studying it. Also, you can go out and look for variations in the size of aggregates of the beetles, and you can find out if there's any difference in their survival and so forth. So, was this question they were asking considered proximate or ultimate, as those terms are defined by Alcock? What kind of question is it? Remember the Tinbergen questions. We're just sociobiologists are concerned with one question, but what about those others? Which kind is this? Ultimate or proximate? What do these mean? The evolutionary causes, exactly, we call those ultimate. Not ultimate in a metaphysical sense, okay? This ultimate in terms of evolution, ultimate purpose, the reason it shows up that way in nature. You know, not exactly how the beetles are doing it. Obviously, the beetle has to be built. His nervous system has to be built in such a way that he will aggregate. And then you're dealing with proximate causes. What are the sensory? How does he detect the presence of other beetles? How does that detection result in the aggregation behavior? Like a lot of people in this, in our brain and cognitive sciences department work on proximate issues. My studies in the, of the midbrain tectum of the hamster, I'm dealing with proximate things. But any of those you can then expand on and ask the ultimate questions too about evolution. Why that was so adapted to be that way. And I've done that particularly for anti-predator behavior. So which is the more important question? The proximate or the ultimate? Sorry?
Ultimate.
Yeah, it's, you know, when we say ultimate, it sounds like that's got to be the most important. But, you know, that's a matter of what you value. They're both important questions. If you're dealing with evolution, you want to know the purpose of the behavior, then, of course, you'd say, well, then these ultimate questions are also the most important questions. But if you're really not, that's not your big concern. You want to know how the brain works, how the nervous system works, how it controls behavior, how the senses work. You want to know about sensory detection abilities. You see, these questions are also very important. And to some people, they're more important. So there's no blanket answer to which question is more important. Unless you're a sociobiologist, then of course the ultimate questions are the more important ones. If you're not, then these other questions could easily be the most important. So how did the evolutionary analysis of behavior begin? Remember? Talked about it once. Way back, first class. But it's right in this chapter. How did it begin? You should all know this. Same two people? Come on. The rest of you guys. That's right. But how did it begin as a science? When did people get analytic about and start asking real sociobiology questions?
Darwin.
That's right. This is the book we cited before. This is Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals. This is a reprint of the 1872 book by Darwin. Okay. And remember, he deals with these social behaviors of dogs. Remember these pictures I showed? You know, the aggressive dog and the submissive dog. You know, you all recognize these if you've been around dogs, because all dogs do these things. You know. And he talked about the evolution of these behaviors. He also applied it to humans. He also studied social insects, and he realized that the presence of sterile workers was a big problem for theory of evolution. And he presented a solution to it that has been expanded on since, but it's still accepted as the basic kind of evolution, that those workers share genes with the animals that are reproducing. So it really did begin in, as a science anyway, with Darwin. It didn't get going very fast. And if you look at the slides I put on the web, you'll see the few pictures again from Darwin. I also put this picture that Alcock reproduces is two-thirds of the picture from the sociobiology book by Gil Wilson. So I put the Wilson one on. It gives his interpretation of how these different sciences that deal with the ultimate questions, proximate questions, and so forth, would develop. And he's been basically correct about that, except that I would say ethology has maintained a vigorous existence and hasn't been swallowed up at all by sociobiology, because many of the things ethologists deal with are not social behavior. Okay, just a couple more questions. Why is variation within species so important for evolution? And I point out there, you'll find that I quote something from page 18 of the text about how Darwin in On the Origin of Species, his famous 1859 book published in London, Darwin devoted an entire chapter to evidence for variation within living species. It was very important for him to establish that there was a lot of variation within species. Okay? Because evolution works on that variation by selecting some variants and rejecting others in multiple generations. And that was critical. So if he could show it in living species, he then could assume that it's probably always been that way. There's been a lot of variation. That's essential for evolution to work. Did E.O. Wilson invent this field of sociobiology? Well, we said Darwin asked sociobiology the question. But in fact, it didn't go from Darwin to E.O. Wilson. Remember what I said? E.O. Wilson was reviewing a lot of studies. And the book just points out a few of the more important things. And let's see. Yeah, on page 19, you'll see he cites there that Wilson was not even the first modern biologist to use selectionist thinking to examine the big issues in social evolution. And he points out George Williams, Robert Trivers, William Hamilton, and a few others. Hamilton's particularly important, but also Trivers, and these people will be cited later in the book, so you'll see the kind of work they did. And a lot of that was critical to triggering Wilson's energy in writing that huge book. Wilson was a man that he's a real synthesizer. He was a voracious reader. When I met him, I told him a little bit about my work in brain and behavior, and right away he wanted me to send him all the papers. I said, "You would actually read them?" He said, "Oh yes." He said, "I read a lot." He said, "Well, that was an understatement. He reads huge amounts." And after he did his sociobiology work, he's gone on to be one of the main proponents of biological diversity. And these books are also very well referenced and everything. He reads an enormous amount and is able to synthesize a lot. That's why his producing this book by bringing together the work on evolution of social behavior was so important. And he gave it the name. And I think he had the right to give it a name. It stuck. He didn't invent the field, but he did invent the name. Sociobiology. You know, it was called other things then. There were some ethologists that dealt with evolutionary issues. And right away, when people were saying he invented this field, I realized that I had books on social behavior in animals already that preceded Wilson. And in this move I just made, I found some of those books I still had. I hope I haven't thrown them all away. So I knew something of the history of the field, but they weren't called sociobiology. So the field has increased since Wilson. it was held back a little bit by this political opposition, but in fact, serious animal behaviorists realized how important these kinds of questions were and that they would help us explain a number of peculiarities about behavior that we could not explain without an evolutionary view. And that same approach is now influencing psychology. So now we have the field called evolutionary psychology, or even evolutionary cognition, you know, where we're finding that we can understand better some aspects of human psychology, or primate psychology, but particularly human psychology and cognitive behavior, cognitive abilities, by looking at it from the standpoint, why did it evolve? How did it help people to survive better to the point of passing on their genes, reproducing? So I appreciate John Alcock writing this book, and I hope you enjoy it. We'll continue with it next time.